But to make up for that irremediable power, which was exasperating even for him, he had a cordiality that won the immediate confidence of others and a stupendous capacity for work. In a short time he had increased the production of ice to such a degree that it was too much for the local market, and Aureliano Triste had to think about the possibility of expanding the business to other towns in the swamp. It was then that he thought of the decisive step, not only for the modernization of his business, but to link the town with the rest of the world. "We have to bring in the railroad," he said. That was the first time that the word had ever been heard in Macondo. Looking at the sketch that Aureliano Triste drew on the table, and that was a direct descendant of the plans with which José Arcadio Buendía had illustrated his project for solar warfare, Úrsula confirmed her impression that time was going in a circle. But unlike his forebear, Aureliano Triste did not lose any sleep or appetite, nor did he torment anyone with crises of ill humor. But he considered the most harebrained of projects as immediate possibilities, made rational calculations about costs and dates, and brought them off without any intermediate exasperation. If Aureliano II had something of his great-grandfather in him and lacked something of Colonel Aureliano Buendía, it was an absolute indifference to mockery, and he gave the money to bring the railroad with the same light-hearted air with which he had given it for his brother's absurd navigation project. Aureliano Triste consulted the calendar and left the following Wednesday, planning to return after the rains had passed. There was no more news of him. Aureliano Centeno, overwhelmed by the abundance of the factory, had already begun to experiment with the production of ice with a base of fruit juices instead of water. And without knowing it or thinking about it, he conceived the essential fundamentals for the invention of sherbet. In that way, he planned to diversify the production of an enterprise he considered his own. Because his brother showed no signs of returning after the rains had passed, and a whole summer had gone by with no news of him. At the start of another winter, however, a woman who was washing clothes in the river during the hottest time of the day ran screaming down the main street in an alarming state of commotion. "It's coming," she finally explained, "something frightful, like a kitchen dragging a village behind it." At that moment, the town was shaken by a whistle with a fearful echo and a loud, panting respiration. During the previous weeks, they had seen the gangs who were laying ties and tracks, and no one paid attention to them because they thought it was some new trick of the gypsies. Coming back with whistles and tambourines, and their age-old and discredited song and dance about the qualities of some concoction put together by journeyman geniuses of Jerusalem. But when they recovered from the noise of the whistles and the snorting, all the inhabitants ran out into the street and saw Aureliano Triste waving from the locomotive, and in a trance they saw the flower-bedecked train which was arriving for the first time 8 months late. The innocent yellow train that was to bring so many ambiguities and certainties, so many pleasant and unpleasant moments, so many changes, calamities, and feelings of nostalgia to Macondo. Dazzled by so many and such marvelous inventions, the people of Macondo did not know where their amazement began. They stayed up all night looking at the pale electric bulbs fed by the plant that Aureliano Triste had brought back when the train made its second trip, and it took time and effort for them to grow accustomed to its obsessive tum-tum. They became indignant over the living images that the prosperous merchant Bruno Crespi projected in the theater with the lion-head ticket windows, for a character who had died and was buried in one film, and for whose misfortune tears of affliction had been shed, would reappear alive and transformed into an Arab in the next one. The audience, who paid 2 cents apiece to share the difficulties of the actors, would not tolerate that outlandish fraud, and they broke up the seats. The mayor, at the urging of Bruno Crespi, explained in a proclamation that the cinema was a machine of illusions that did not merit the emotional outbursts of the audience. With that discouraging explanation, many felt that they had been the victims of some new and showy gypsy business, and they decided not to return to the movies, considering that they already had too many troubles of their own to weep over the acted-out misfortunes of imaginary beings. Something similar happened with the cylinder phonographs that the merry matrons from France brought with them as a substitute for the antiquated hand organs, and that for a time had serious effects on the livelihood of the band of musicians. At first, curiosity increased the clientele on the forbidden street, and there was even word of respectable ladies who disguised themselves as workers in order to observe the novelty of the phonograph from first hand. But from so much and such close observation, they soon reached the conclusion that it was not an enchanted mill as everyone had thought, and as the matrons had said, but a mechanical trick that could not be compared with something so moving, so human, and so full of everyday truth as a band of musicians. It was such a serious disappointment that when phonographs became so popular that there was one in every house, they were not considered objects for amusement for adults, but as something good for children to take apart.